You are listening to Type Radio. My name is John L. Walters, editor of I. Now we're talking.
Do you have plans after I magazine? I mean, do you, or is I as I's for life?
Well,
I'm for life.
Of course, I is not my entire life.
Yeah.
And I have quite a busy triple career, and I also have a family and a home and all the things out, you know, friends and the things outside work, which are very consuming. And I guess all my areas of work, there are networks of friendships and collaborations which are very enriching and nourishing. So I would hate to abandon those for no good reason. I Magazine is at a very interesting position in its history because we are now part of a very big publishing group called Haymarket Brand Media. And whereas our previous owners were a tiny company called Quantum, who used to publish magazines like Meat Trades Journal and British Baker and Packaging News.
Excellent.
So I Magazine was an anomaly within this tiny group. But we formed a kind of temporary autonomous zone within the company. I say we, it was really just me. And the magazine came out. We published some fantastic issues, including you know, things I'm particularly proud of are issues like number 48, which have the big Judith Williamson piece, and I-53, which is our brand madness issue. I was just talking to Joe about this last night, the guy who's doing the branding of fear in any second now. But Quantum had to sell off. They sold all the things in their portfolio, and we were bought by Haymarket, which is a very big publisher. Worldwide, it employs 2,000 people. It has about 100 titles, magazines, websites, conferences, different things, and it's very profitable. It's a very profit-oriented company, but they didn't have a design magazine, and I think they've always had aspirations to become a player in the international design market, and they realized the quality of I. So the question that everybody asked me when Haymarket took over the magazine, which happened at between issues 55 and 56, everyone said, is Haymarket going to change the magazine? Is it going to make it more commercial? Is it going to have more advertising? Is it going to change the shape? Is it going to change the pagination? Are you going to have an in-house designer who works on five other magazines? Lots of questions and, you know, quite either anxious or aggressive. And, of course, I also had lots of questions from the new owners of I, which is, why do we have a designer who lives 5 miles away? Why do we have to use this printer? Why do we have to photograph everything? Why do we have to pay for this? Why, you know, there's lots of questions about the way that we do things. And to their credit, I explained everything, and over time they understood the way the magazine works, the way the readers, the relationship we have with our readers, who are graphic designers and sometimes very obsessive graphic designers who notice if the binding is slightly wrong or...
Do you get comments like that? Do you get...
We had a fantastic letter from, a very polite letter from a Swiss subscriber whose issue... I think he had the end of a run and there was a tiny mistake in the binding and he took a photograph of it and and I showed this to my publisher and he'd never seen anything like this before because... You know, they publish magazines that go out every week, and you know, if there's a slight registration problem, you know.
So this is what you're coming into.
These are our readers.
They're the freaks.
They're Swiss. They're in South America. They're in uptown New York. They're in New Zealand. They look very carefully at every aspect of the magazine. And then one day, I had a visit from some professors from the States who said, can we come and visit the I office? And I said, sure. And of course, six months later, when they arrived, we had moved to this totally new office in Hammersmith, this big place full of other magazines. And they said, we're just bringing a few students. And they came to reception. And I said, oh, where are the students? And they said, well, everybody wanted to come. They're sitting on the pavement outside. And so there on the pavement were 20 American graphic design students, all with their backpacks and their cameras. And they said, okay, you better come in. And we booked the boardroom very quickly. And the people in Haymarket were completely flabbergasted. Why did these students come from all this way to look at this boardroom with no pictures? All we had was one copy of I on the table, and they're there taking photographs. And we talked about design for half an hour, and then they said, you write about music, are there any cool places to go? So I said, well, go to the Spitz in Spitalfields, because it's very good for world music and jazz and DJ sets and kind of underground things. And then, you know, a few weeks later, thank you for telling us about the Spitz, we had a great time. And then I got this beautiful piece of letterpress saying thank you for the visit. But also in the office, I think the managers and publishers realized that we have, in fact, Rufus Ollins, who is the CEO of the whole division of Brown Media, said, the great thing about I is that you have a great product, but you have a fantastic community. And I think the way that the company is now thinking is, can we do more for this community than just one magazine? Can we do talks or a conference or a bigger website or a website that does more things? Maybe interviews or... For example. Or can we do more publications or supplements? So this is we're in a very interesting stage of development, because I think the magazine could increase this relationship with the readers. On the other hand,
are you forced to do that for sales, or is it natural that this would happen?
Well, I think it's natural that any magazine changes, evolves. I mean, if you look at I number 1 and I number 24, and just look through them, even the issues that I've edited over a period of time, you'll see very, very big differences.
But actually, something you said the other evening, which I thought was quite interesting, if you look at I, the only thing that it's sort of a timeless magazine, and the only thing that looks old is the advertising, which I thought was quite nice.
That's something someone said to me, it was a very interesting insight, that if you look in early issues, the advertising does look...
It's of that particular
time. But this is one of the great features of the design that Stephen Coates and then Nick Bell and then Simon Esterson have forged in the magazine, which is there's a kind of selfless attention to the detail and it's respecting the designers whose work is shown in the magazine. And if that design work is good, the editorial design kind of pulls back a little bit, and you're seeing something that's quite strong. I mean, I could also point to things which are very much of their time, but the other thing is that the magazine has kept the same dimensions, which is 210 by 297 by 237.
That's for the Swiss list.
It's not A4.
It's not A4. And Pete Schroeder's would be very pleased. but it's kept the same dimensions. We've also kept the same... since we're talking on type radio, we've had News Gothic for the folios since issue 1. And we've kept Performer for the body type since issue 21. But there are also things that evolve. For example, that we do a back issue ad, which is a kind of... this is where we find a designer who could be completely unknown or somebody quite famous, like Stefan Sagmeister, or, as in this case, Cornel Windland. And until recently, this was a full bleed picture with a comment, and Cornell sent us a Polaroid. So Simon said, well, it's time we changed the design, so we just did something new. So there are little things that we can evolve and change. And I think that, of course, Haymarket, to go back to your question, Haymarket as a company is a very dynamic, expanding company. I mean, they're always buying new magazines. They're moving, I mean, they move my office around, which drives me crazy. I'm now in an open plan office, for example. But I think they recognize something that has a quality and that has a value and that has a commercial value. We're not seen as being a museum piece or being a little indulgence. You know, it's not a personal project that perhaps needs protection through an Arts Council grant or a preservation order. And I think there are some design magazines which perhaps take that role. You know, they're very special and they occupy a very particular part of the culture. But I think it's the nature of I that it has to be both. Actually, Max Brandsma said something very wise, that it's a cultural magazine and it is also a business magazine, and you can't separate, you can't take one from the other. You have to remember, when you're talking about it as a cultural magazine, you have to remember it's a business magazine and vice versa. I was talking to Simone Wolfe, the organizer of this conference this morning, about this very issue, that if you don't look after the business side of the magazine, and we now have a very good business commercial manager, then you can't do all the fantastic creative things and editorial things. And of course, there are certain projects and certain subjects that at the moment would be very difficult for me to pursue in terms of research or in terms of writers I would like to engage or maybe spend a longer time working with. And if we can make bigger profits for the magazine and we can expand things, that will give me the freedom to do more things. So I see this as quite a positive thing, but of course it also makes the future more unknown. And it makes it exciting.
But are you also, being in such a large publishing group, are you also, do they ask for advice in terms of who designs what magazine? I mean, it's an ideal situation.
Very, very rarely. And a couple of times, all I've said was, here's a list of people you should talk to.
Yeah, because it's and a resource now. I mean, if there's a wine magazine, you would say, what wine do you really know?
But it doesn't happen very often. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the design director said, oh, it's fantastic we have iMagazine now because we get a much better quality of people applying for design jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm very happy that we get good designers applying for business magazines and so on, that can only be good. But occasionally someone will ask my advice, but not very often. I was very happy to recommend Nick Bell for a big branding project, which is now going ahead, which is very exciting for him and be very nice to see. And that was through Haymarket, so maybe something we'll feature an eye in 2 years' time when it's finished. Who knows?
More or less, like, it's a sort of a recurring theme that you are in a position of power. Although you will deny that, I suppose.
Well,
are you taken back or intimidated by requests of people who want to be in the magazine?
I have to be pretty tough, I guess. Of course, power is a dangerous thing, and it's one reason I don't attend too many conferences. I also attend design events anonymously, because people don't see my photograph in the magazine. I sometimes will go to a DNAD thing and I turn my name badge around so that I don't get people coming up to me very much. In a sense, I don't mind spending time with designers, because I think if they get to know me, they know that they can't really bribe me or give me favours. I've been, this conference, I've been wearing a very nice scarf that was given to me by a design company who have never featured in the magazine, and it doesn't really make any difference to me.
Please do not send him a scarf.
I mean, I'm wearing a t-shirt that's actually, since this is tight radio, I'm wearing a t-shirt which is an Alan Kitching design from the Clerkenwell Festival. But if I remember rightly, I paid for this t-shirt. So. And also, in a sense, sometimes I'm not the right person to approach, first of all, for a piece in eye. Sometimes it's best to talk to a designer who is sympathetic and understands the sector. So, for example, some of the freelance designers who write semi-regularly for the magazine, they have their antennae out in particular areas of design, of what's interesting in web design, or what's very unusual in fine printing, or maybe in other aspects of visual culture. So I'm sometimes, to go back to my analogy of the ringmaster, I'm looking for people who know, they're not only the great acrobats, they know the best acrobats. and of course I can't, you know, I'm just one guy, I can't know everything, I don't attempt to know everything. I have, to go back to our designers, Simon Esterson, I could take a very good example in the new issue. We had most of the contents were prepared for this issue, but we didn't have a really compelling subject for picture, which is a spread that occurs at the front of the magazine. And Simon said, I've just been talking to the guys from Bibliotheque who are doing this exhibition in a couple of weeks' time of the Munich Olympics. And they're great enthusiasts, they're great curators of this information design work. And Simon said, I'm just going to pop over to their studio and have a look. So Simon found this one single piece of print work. It's a piece of information design. It's very elegant. It's actually by Michael Burke, a British designer working under the direction of Otto Leischer, who did the whole branding for the Munich Olympics in 72. And we got Anthony Oliver. We were very late by this time. So Anthony Oliver came into Simon's studio at the weekend to take photographs of this piece. Mason, who had never written, I don't think he'd ever written for any magazine before, but Mason Wells from Bibliotheque wrote a very nice little piece. And then I said, well, can you tell us a little more about the technical side? He said, oh, I'll get one of our guys to tell me. You know, eventually we had a little dialogue going about the different aspects of the design. So this is a kind of collaborative piece, talking to Michael, who is very much, still very active in education and information design. So this was quite a spontaneous piece that happened quite late on in the production of the magazine. And then we had a layout, and then Simon called up, said, you know, we were just, this guy, it doesn't really look right this way around. So we turned it. And you can see the, you know, so this is not a kind of fancy, oh, we'll yeah, try some cool.
You have to make the same movement as when you look at the centerfold in Playboy magazine.
Yeah, that's exactly what they were thinking.
Okay, so it's design porn. But, well, in fact, it's, to use the expression that we used in the piece about Good magazine, it's lashings of information porn.
Last question?
Yeah.
How would you like to be remembered?
Oh, I'd like to be remembered by my daughters and their families and my friends.
And in what way?
As a nice guy.
Before you finish with that, that's what I'm really surprised. I am quite surprised that you are a very nice person. Like, you don't...
Typical journalist.
You're not the journal. How I expect
smoking, I mean, swearing, drinking.
Yeah, exactly.
Wearing a raincoat.
Yeah.
Well, I wear a raincoat.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, because I don't know, at least the ones I've encountered in, I don't know, in London, you're very different to... Yeah, you're very polite. That's what I'm surprised about. I mean...
Well, let me say, I know about journalism, I learnt from my wife, Claire Walters, and she started life as a teacher and then became a book editor and then became trained as a journalist. And then when we had children, she said, well, you know, this is easy, you could do this. And she taught me how to be a journalist. So I had a fantastic education from my wife, and I realized very quickly that in Britain you get hired not necessarily because of your knowledge of the subject, but because you can write well or you can edit well. So I felt it was very interesting to learn to become a journalist, already knowing quite a lot about, in my case, music, and also already having friendships with designers and knowing a lot about cultural work in general. But I didn't leave school to become a journalist to go and scoop, you know, the latest murders or sex scandals. I became a journalist in order to express things that I was already interested in. So I have it's a very different kind of education, and I think that's been very, very valuable, because I now feel I'm a better journalist than I was ever a musician. But the experience of being a musician has been invaluable in being a journalist. And if I talk to journalism students, I sometimes say, you have to have subjects that you have a passion for, as well as just being a journalist. It's, you know, journalism and writing is a great tool. And also, if you talk to designers, it's, if you can write, even if it's only on a very simple level, you are in a good position to communicate your ideas. The ideas that can't just be explained, if you're talking to, say, a client or students, that can't merely be explained in visual terms. And you also have an advantage over writers like myself, because you have this fantastic visual flair and education. So it's writing is a great life tool, which is worth learning whatever you do. And I would it's not so difficult.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Type rate.